Need a little volume.
Hang on. I'm trying to figure it out. He turned everything off.
All right, all right. There you go.
Jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now, right here, right now.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer.
Okay, we are live.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Jimmy working the board over there, toes and fingers going in.
Had the previous person turned almost everything off. But before we go, I just would like to know that if you didn't know, both Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones played on that song.
Really?
They were studio musicians, which is how they met. Back to you, Chief.
Were you trying to draw some sort of a comparison between Goldfinger and Lou?
Still the greatest Bond introduction song or theme song for any Bond movie, Shirley Bassey.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That is just a, you know, and there's a great Netflix show on Bond theme songs, and it's hilarious how they had to sort of in some cases really cajole musicians to come on and perform the stuff, and you would think that there would be some real, you know, rush to get your name in there on these shows, but not so much. I think especially when they started with the kind of the Roger Moore run there with a kind of campy Bond film sequence. But there was some discussion in the movie, I think, of people basically saying, "Yeah, I don't want to come in behind, you know, behind Goldfinger, behind Shirley Bassey, because that song is almost impossible to beat."
Well, where did that scene when they were chasing him in the car? Not chasing him. The girl was trying to shoot him. I don't know where she came from. I forget where that part was. But that incredible scene of the highway up and down, where you could look down. Where was that filmed?
Switzerland.
I think it was filmed in Switzerland. Yeah.
But that was really, what a gorgeous area. I mean that where they filmed it. Well, you weren't be driving that road at night, I don't think. With the
no, and I mean, I've taken the train across Switzerland, and it's one of those rides where, as you're looking down from your car, it's just one one expansive, gorgeous vista after another, and it's a little bit like driving west from Denver. The views just get better the further you go. So,
well,
in any event, thanks for that intro song, because that's one of my favorites.
Without hitting a raw subject, they were building trains through the Alps, sort of the I think about the same time we were doing stuff here. Did they import people like from China, like we did, to do that, or was it local labor?
I suspect they used Italians.
Hey, careful with that.
and let me just say that we've had this discussion several years back. The Swiss do not mess around with their construction projects, and you want to talk about long-term thinking. Every railroad tunnel, every car tunnel has a side cut into it that leads to a large storage area full of weapons or a communications node.
Really?
Or...
Well, that had to come after.
No. They do it when they build them. And they've been doing it for decades. Every bridge that gets built in Switzerland over a major highway,
I'm talking 1870.
Tom.
Really?
You're not... This neutrality thing, they take very seriously, and they've been every building, you know, is designed to be fought from. Their tunnels all have cuts off them that house and store equipment or underground living quarters. Their bridges have demolition charges built into them when they are constructed.
Wow.
These cute little Swiss...
They're lucky somebody doesn't find the key and blow them up.
These cute little Swiss farmhouses that you see as you're riding along through the valleys, a certain number of them are pure facade. They have gun emplacements in them, anti-aircraft missiles stationed inside, so that the roofs just come off.
Well, does everybody have to go in the army as a public service?
Yep, the men do.
Yeah,
and then you know, we were driving, taking a bus from Geneva to Zermatt, which is where the Matterhorn is, and I had my kids with me, and I was describing this to them. I said, you know, this place is armed to the teeth. And they were saying, no, you know, we don't see anything. And I said, well, that's the secret. And as if God himself was listening to me and said, you know what, I'm gonna make old Lou sound really knowledgeable here. We stop on the road. There's a roadblock on the road. We stop, and out of this barn next to the highway comes this Swiss jet fighter, one of their fighters, taxiing out of the barn, and he taxis out onto the highway and takes off.
Wow.
So this, there's a great book by John McPhee, the brilliant New Yorker author who has written some of the best books I've ever read, nonfiction I've ever read. But it's called La Place de la Concorde Suisse, and it talks about the fact that they are armed and how their military service structure works in a state where, you know, we are officially neutral and we don't take sides with anybody. But if you want to mess with us, it's going to cost you. And, you know, there they are.
That's pretty much why Germany left them alone.
Well, yeah, it's why pretty much everybody leaves them alone. That if you want to, I mean, with nuclear weapons, you could devastate the place.
But yeah.
I will tell you, they are prepared to fight that, and practice it. You know, they practice dealing with nuclear attacks.
Do you think they have the capability themselves?
With nukes, no.
Yeah.
No.
How do you know?
I mean, I think they believe that the ability to crash the world's banking system, or at least, let me put it this way, to crash the banking system of the people who matter in the world.
Yeah.
I think they believe that's enough of a deterrent.
Lou, I know this is not your game necessarily, but you get around. You make Marco Polo look like a local boy sometimes. We had a little bit of a crack. In the end, I know everybody's going to be outraged when I say this, a little bit of a crack in the crypto world the other day, and we bounced back some.
Now, I saw the email traffic on that. I'm sort of interested in what you were talking about.
Well, we've gone from, and again, I am not the expert, so don't. This is just from what I hear from people on the show. We've kind of gone from, you know, everybody has their own personal ID, or you can have your own wallet, to having these exchanges, and somehow or another, you can put the thing in what I guess masquerades for street name under a stock, where it can be at an exchange, and somehow they can even lend it out, and you can borrow for the stuff, which to me puts it in very dangerous territory. But
so we're talking about Bitcoin, right?
Well, this happened,
or something comparable?
This happened in Ether, which is, I guess, one of the second biggest ones. There's a bunch of them. And I've never been a believer that this system is so perfect. I don't think people say, and you know, Kenny said it a few times, I'm not giving Kenny any crap, I would never do that. He's talking about it can be regulated. And one day I was asking Kenny, I go, how do you regulate something when there's nobody to call? I mean, you can regulate PTI because you can call my brother and say, what the hell are you doing? Right? How do you regulate something where everybody says nobody, there's no founder, you know, like a guy with a beard came out of the Shaolin temple, did this for the world, and walked back up, and nobody even knows who the guy was.
So I'm in the same context here. Are we talking about a bank?
Are we talking about
an exchange? What are we talking about?
There's some sort of crypto exchange. They're not like the OCC, or they're not like the New York Stock Exchange. They're something. They call themselves an exchange. My point is, if something were to blip here, if somebody were to say, hey, wait a minute, somebody actually is in Bitcoin, and I'm not saying it's going to happen, you know, stealing something, like if Lou would have bought $30,000 of Bitcoin 5 years ago and you lost your password, theoretically, you're bleep out of luck, and your 30 grand will be sitting there 4 centuries from now. I don't believe that for a second. I never have. I mean, somebody will find a way to figure out what the dormant accounts or whatever. Plus, if you're a PTI client and we send you statements and we get them back, I don't know if it's 3 or 4 months in a row, we have to track you down, or they're gonna send your money to the state. How the hell?
Yes.
How does a place like this have no rules and say they're regulated? Anyway, my point is, if there was to be a problem there, where's the problem? Is it? I mean, somebody could be smart and say, "Well, geez, a bunch of drug guys have it." Who holds? There's $3 trillion. Russell was saying yesterday, roughly, in Bitcoin hold and in crypto wealth, shall we say? If 2/3 of that were to vanish, who's hurt? I mean, I'm trying to figure out where, because obviously for my clients, if it's 50 drug dealers in Mexico, I guess I don't care. I don't know. I don't want anybody to lose money. But if it's something that's going to take down part of the market or something like that, or if there's some banks involved, I guess that's a problem. And I can't get my fingers around it or my arms around it.
I mean, speaking as a lawyer, you know, who operates in a world of regulations and statutes, the idea that people would put money into something, and again, I'm not really clear as to exactly how Bitcoin gets used. I mean, you say I'm going to pay you in Bitcoin. It's an exchange on an unregulated market with a fluctuating, heavily and significantly fluctuating valued thing.
Very, very so, correct. Yes.
So you're basically saying, I mean, my initial question is, what's the investment? How do you buy it? Where does the money, when you transfer actual real money?
Hell, you can go to the gas station and get it at the ATM.
I know. When you do that, when you transfer money into buy Bitcoin, where does your money go?
That's the $1 million. It's the $1 million question. But I mean, do you know? I guess without being too personal, do you know any Swiss law firm that gets paid by Bitcoin from people in China and South America and places?
Well, this kind of thing is, and it would be anathema to the Swiss banking system.
Or anybody, not just Swiss. I just use that because.
I mean, just in particular, because the Swiss, you know, the whole point of the Swiss system is trust. you know, we are neutral. We don't have politics. You can pretty much put anything in our system, although that's not the case anymore. But it used to be that you could put anything in our system, and it would be there, and you would have access to it, and your heirs could have access to it, and you know, if you needed to flee your country for whatever reason, you could still, because we don't care, you could still reach whatever assets you've secreted with us. Bitcoin seems like to be the exact opposite of that.
Oh yeah.
Who has access to the, you know, to the Bitcoin? Who is running the trading? Is it some algorithm, as I understand it? But who writes the algorithm? And who's monitoring the algorithm to make sure it's?
See, these are all questions that nobody seems to. The answer is going to be everybody's monitoring it, whatever that means.
Yeah, and I understand that. I understand the transparency theory there. But the short answer is that at some point, if you've got any kind of I'm not telling you anything. If you've got any kind of centralized processing, which you have to have because you're making transactions on the stuff, something is controlling those transactions. If you've got any kind of centralized processing, you've got the potential for somebody, or with AI, something coming in and saying, I want to look at this, and I'm gonna have access to it. It's unthinkable to me that the NSA and China's state security organs, and probably the FSB in Russia, and several other international outfits that specialize in these kinds of espionage activities, do not have keys to get into that system and see exactly who's doing what with how much.
Well, supposedly you can trace every transaction to like the machine and so forth, but I find it, if Lou would have walked into an ATM, actually, my brother did this about, God, how long ago was it, Jimmy? He was telling you yesterday. How many years ago he went into the ATM in his neighborhood and he bought like $20 worth, and of course it only gave him $16 worth of Bitcoin. The fee was like 20%, right? So the $4 went to the ATM. And,
so where did the, when he was buying it, who was he buying it from?
Who gets that money?
Well, when I go in and I want to buy Bitcoin.
Somebody evidently sold it to him, because you can mine the thing where you get one for free if you mine it, go through the algorithm. So you end up with one for free, and then you can turn around and sell it bits and pieces, and I guess it's infinitely divisible. You know, if somebody wants to come in and buy $20 worth, you can sell them like, you know, 1/1500th of a Bitcoin.
Well, and again, this is way beyond my area of expertise.
Well, me too, but where I'm trying to get...
But this sounds like a religion.
Well, it does. To those people, it is. But there's two kinds of risk here. One is, I mean, Jimmy and I know a guy in a local tavern. He's got more money than God, and he bought, like, what do you say, Jimmy, five of them when they were like 10 grand. Another, you know, yeah. They were 120. And Lou, I'm not worried about him. You know, if it goes back to 10, you know, guess what? It was a nice ride. He got to talk about it in the bar for 20 years. But if he'd have borrowed money at 75, and then it went to 125, it went down to zero. Now can he pay the debt? Just like the 2008 thing. I mean, this is the similarities that I see from my end. Is okay if the mortgages crashed, which they did. Who's hurt? Well, obviously, Lehman was hurt. Bear Stearns was hurt. There were a couple of banks in Germany that I thought I knew the names of most of the big banks in Germany. Lou, I never heard of these people, and all of a sudden they're in trouble. There's a couple of places in Britain that were in trouble. I never heard of those banks. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is if, and I give this a, you know, my if, 1 in 1,000 chance of something bad happening here, but that is my job for my clients, is to figure out where the risk could be, how bad it could be, and protect them from it. I mean, that's what I do for a living. Sort of the same way you do. You try and protect people. And now the question is, I have no idea where these pockets are. If it's a bunch of drug dealers that bought them at 10,000 and went to 100 and went back down again, I guess I don't really give a crap, do I? But if there's a couple of banks that are in this that are eyeballs, and all of a sudden they're going to take other banks with them, you know, now I got a problem with it, but I have no idea. I thought maybe, you know, the... It's hard. Does anybody know? I guess is the question. Where the risks are.
Well, the whole. I heard an interesting discussion. I actually listen to other podcasts sometimes, and it was a high level Trump advisor who was talking about the fact that they were in Bitcoin. And the interviewer said, "Why would you do that?" And he said, "Because we were debanked in 2021 and 2022. And when Capital One calls me and says the 30 accounts that you have with us are being closed, tell us where to send the check." With no explanation, he said, "You turn to this because apparently it's." The Wild West, and you can get your banking services through this entity.
Trump also has his own coin, and he wants to make money on it.
Well, but I mean that was an outgrowth. I think that's an outgrowth of the debanking. I mean, they got into it, and because they were forced into it, or at least that's the story, they were forced into it, and then they said, okay, how can we?
I don't buy that for a second, but. Anyway,
well, they were. I mean, the fact that they were debanked is a matter of public record. So,
well, there were stories that, in one hand, was it Citigroup or one of those places? One group was kicking them out, while another group was giving them a loan.
I'm sure that's probably true, but you know, the fact that how many times do you have to be debanked before you say I'm not trusting?
Well,
not
but
trusting
it,
the system.
You know, without going into it, the man was. Whether he should have or shouldn't have been, let's not get into it. But, I mean, the man was convicted, so they essentially
not in 2022.
Well, so what did they debank him for?
Because of politics, Tom.
Well, they did.
This was part of.
Well, I know somebody one of the marijuana distributorships here, and they had a ATM in the lobby, and the bank found out that it was in the lobby of one of those places, and not only. Cut off that account. They cut off his kid's account. I mean, why do people do stuff like that?
I can at least say, okay, you're engaged in activity that is outside our regulatory scope.
But his kids.
What happened with the Trumps, and it, you know, it wasn't just the Donald. It was Melania and the kids and everybody else. What happened with the Trumps was, as I assume, it was part of the Biden administration effort to try to blow him up so that he couldn't run again. I mean, this was all. Pretty well orchestrated, I think we now understand.
We're not, that whole group, anyway.
In any event, that sounds like a plausible reason why they would end up in Bitcoin. But
okay, well, it's a better reason than most have. Well, I guess it's a reason why drug dealers don't go there either, right?
Well, I mean, listening to except that they had a long history with these banks. And all of a sudden the plug got pulled.
Well, yeah,
in any event,
what I'm saying, I'm trying. Hey, a couple
that
people
at least
have
makes sense.
A couple people have written in, want to know what your take. And we've been talking. This is like VA week. And somebody want to know what your take is. I don't know if you listened in, but we've had a bunch of people.
I did. I listened to the show yesterday.
It was Mark was pretty spot on. I had no idea that he had spent 3 years like as an orderly in a VA home. When he was doing his psychological residency. What was your take on that? Agree, disagree?
What
everybody's been saying this week about the psychological stuff, and then Kenny's group raising money for that with the Headstrong group, and
I mean, I have a close family member who's drawing pretty close to 100% disability from the VA for psychological injury.
Along a spectrum that. Dr. Mark talked about yesterday. Where's he?
He's certainly functional, but you know, I mean, he's dealing with the impact of, you know, what he saw, what he did, you know, what he was involved in, and it was, you know, Gulf War. So
is he getting any better?
As far as I know, yes. You know, the whatever the treatment plan is, and I don't know all the details, but whatever the treatment plan is, it seems to be working. But yeah, these Let me put it this way. I don't think the psychological injury that soldiers are sustaining, or that soldiers sustain, is any different now than it was 1,000 years ago. I think you see the horror, you see the terrible things that happen. You're required to do terrible things, and you know, for generations, the advice was, you deal with it. This is the card. These are the cards you were dealt. This is the hand you were dealt. Deal with it. It wasn't until we started really talking to people about what they had experienced and its impact on them, in with the rise of modern psychiatry in the 20th century, that I think we started assessing just how this was working. World War II. If you talk to guys who did it, you know, deep dives into World War II vets and guys who were actively involved in combat, you start hearing stories about the kind of psychological injuries that Mark was talking about yesterday that manifested themselves and were effectively untreated. I'm trying to remember. I think it was in one of my classmates' books called Hellhawks, when he was writing about a P-47 unit in Europe. So the P-47 was the Thunderbolt. It was a big ground attack aircraft. It came in toward the end of the latter half of the war. But in Europe, they used them, some air-to-air stuff. But this unit, pick your unit's specialty, was ground attack. So they were literally going in, and the thing had, I think, 650 caliber machine guns mounted underneath. And it's flying slow enough, you know, 300, 400 miles an hour, flying slow enough that you could actually watch what your bullets were doing. And they were flying so low and making attacks that were, you know, they were attacking troop trains and trucks and anything that was moving on the roads, you know, tanks. They were shooting the place up. And they were low enough that, you know, you would hit like a troop carrier train or a truck with troops in it, and body parts would, you know, 50 cal tears people apart. The body parts would fly up in the air. This particular pilot had blood, you know, going across his windscreen as he flew through the cloud of pieces that he had just shredded with his guns. And this was apparently a common enough that it, you know, it they saw it regularly. They all saw it. They all went through it. And he developed, apparently, again, this is all untreated, he developed a paralysis in his right hand.
Whoa.
You know, as a result of what he saw.
How much, Mark was talking about the different wars are different, not in the trauma necessarily, but in the reception home. He said, what did he say, after World War II? I'm trying to remember everything he said. He said after World War II, some towns had 20 and 25 organizations for American Legion and Kiwanis, yeah, and all kinds of stuff. There was plenty of things for people to get involved in with people like them, where you could almost, and maybe not even almost, but you could at least have enough people around it that were in the same boat as you, that there was, and the family was probably there too. And there's a lot of that has disappeared.
That was part of the therapeutic process, was to be able to go into places like that and talk about what you'd seen. And you knew that you weren't the Lone Ranger, you know, with what had happened. So you had the ability to at least talk in some places, and I'm sure that was part of the healing process. The guy that I talked about with the paralysis, his wife was aware of it, and she would make his coffee in the mornings when he had one of these paralyzing episodes. But, you know, imagine carrying that with you for a while.
I was surprised when he brought up, I guess if I'd have thought about it, it's stunning, Lou, when you think of the things you should have thought about and don't. He talked about the moral hazard.
Yeah, moral injury.
And he said, you know, you're raised, whatever you're raised, whether you're Protestant or Catholic, Jewish, I mean, you're raised in that go kill people, right? And yeah. And all of a sudden you're someplace and you're in the middle of nowhere and there's one guy and then there's you and you shoot him and you go, what the hell did I just do? What am I doing here? What's he doing here? I mean, either one of them, we might have been able to be friends, for God's sake. It wasn't for this war, and I just shot the guy.
And we ran into this. I mean, you started seeing articles about moral injury, in particular when we started fighting in the Gulf, where we were dealing with cultures that did not look at the idea of non-combatants the way we do. So, for example, they would use children. Now, the Vietnamese did the same thing. The Viet Cong did the same thing. They would use children to carry, you know, grenades or bombs or whatever. And you know, you'd have to shoot a 10-year-old. That would cause
a big problem with me, boy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That is there's a American Sniper, the movie about the Chris. What is it? Chris Kyle, whatever his name was, the guy that had all the. You know, kills in Iraq. I mean, there's a scene in there where he has to shoot a child because the kid is carrying an RPG and he's getting ready to shoot it at American troops. And the trauma that it induces in him is significant. But you can see him saying, you know, he's talking to himself, "Don't pick it up. Don't pick." He's talking about the RPG. "Don't pick it up. Don't pick it up," and the kid picks it up, and he has to shoot him. And those kinds of things are a horror. They are part of war, and they have been for forever. And we just now, I think, are starting to come to grips with the sort of extensive kind of damage that this does to your population. And having seen this, and frankly, as we get into fight, you know, with asymmetric type of conflicts, where the people on the other side are not going to go come out in a set piece battle to fight us, because that's, you know, they're going to lose. They're going to use their children. They're going to use women. They're going to use whatever as weapons. This is where we're going to be looking at.
Well, what is the
and it's going to get? I think it's going to get worse if we automate to the extent we're automating the battlefield, because, I mean, and this has been validated.
Did you?
It's a lot easier. It's a lot easier to blow apart a family in a car from 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 miles away with a drone than it is to point your weapon at them personally and execute everybody.
Do you remember the? You're a Trekkie at heart. You remember the Star Trek episode where the two planets fought wars where they didn't fight the war. They had the simulated attacks, and people used to have to go. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, they would say Earth was fighting Mars, and all of a sudden Mars would attack Earth with a successful attack, simulated attack, and they'd say we just killed 5,000 people. Well, they didn't want any of the damage. They didn't want any of the blood. So 5,000 people would go into these machines and just get
vaporized.
Get vaporized. And so Kirk came and blew up all the machines and said, that's why people don't have war, because it's so messy. We want you. And immediately they declared peace, right?
Well, that was a good way of solving the problem. War is... Was it Sherman? Or I think it was Sherman that said, it's a good thing that war is so terrible, or we would grow too fond of it.
Yeah,
it's inimical. It's inimical to what you and I think of in terms of a civilized worldview, but apparently it's hard coded into our genes. But listening to Mark and then looking at this stuff, the psychological injury issue is a real one. One of the things that is coming out of Ukraine is our discussions about what's going to happen once this stuff stops, and what are we asking people to do. It's the same thing. IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, are having to deal with this. You know, the people on the other side are not. you know, they're just kill everybody, and you know, the more people we can kill, the better we are. And it helps if you are members of a religious sect that says to die like that means you go to Valhalla.
But the people, I guess this is a real tough question. I'm sorry. We seem to have different morals on this. I have a feeling that a lot of the people, the Israeli Army and Air Force, are going to have a real problem the rest of their life for what happened in Gaza. But it's not really a subject. But you
got to remember that it's easier when your opponent is bestial.
Well,
you know,
we try to dehumanize
your opponent all the time. But when your opponent actually acts in an inhuman way, it's easier to kill them.
Well, that's kind of where I'm going with this. This is a very deep question. When we fought the Japanese, okay, I mean, just because, you know, I don't know what's in the mindset of somebody from the Japanese religion or whatever. I mean, I have no idea, but I think people in a lot of ways are. You think all the people from Japan that raped the crap out of Nanking or whatever it was, they were all just okay with that the rest of their life? I can't believe that. I mean. Even though everybody's 18, 19 years old and shooting people and raping people, I don't see how that ever could be. Do you think when they were 65, they were okay with that? I mean, I can't believe any human beings are like that. But maybe I'm wrong there.
If you believe that your opponents are animals and have acted in such a way that there is no redeeming them, then killing them is the option. Now, I can't explain what happened in Nanking and some other, I can't explain what happened in those communities on the side of the Gaza Strip with what the Hamas and Gazans.
Yeah.
I mean you gotta remember Hamas put a couple of thousand people across the fence. The rest of them were civilians in Gaza who willingly took part in the rapes and murders. I can't explain what goes through their heads, but I will tell you this. It makes it a lot easier for your military people to be turned loose against somebody like that. And, you know, no prisoners, no mercy, no whatever, no compassion. When you finally engage them in combat.
But how does this, I guess, well, I'm asking you deep psychological questions here, but I go back, one of the most interesting chapters in a book I ever read was in George Marshall's Soldier and Statesman, and I knew nothing about this, Lou, talk about being ignorant. I just assumed, and when you assume, you make an ass out of you and everybody else, right, that right after World War II, he was assigned the Marshall Plan. He was not. When he drove home, he retired, pulling in the driveway, basically, in Virginia. The phone's ringing, and it's Truman. Hey, you got to go to Asia. And he went there for, was it almost a year, wasn't it? He was, or nine
yeah.
months. And he and his wife, and God, she hated it, tried to make sense of the Chiang Kai-shek, Mao Zedong revolutionary battle, whatever you want to call it, that ended up with Chiang Kai-shek on Taiwan and Mao running in China. He said, he wrote back to Truman, he goes, I can't connect with these people at all. I say, well, look how many people died in the battle yesterday. They don't care.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I can't believe an individual Chinese person doesn't care about his kids or about his shooting somebody. I mean, just because the leaders don't care. I mean, even in Israel, just because Netanyahu thinks everything was justified, if I pull the trigger and all of a sudden I found out I nailed a hospital, I'm going to care. I'm going to be one of these people needing the psychological stuff like we're talking about. I mean, how do those people not care? I mean, human beings can't be that much different, Lou. Can't be.
Oh yeah, they can. And as I said, we warn against all the time using our analyses to project onto other people from other cultures. Other cultures in some cases do not value life, and their leadership does not value life the way we do.
But they value their own life. How do they not apply it to other people?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure the analysis, you know, gets that deep. The idea that the people who are trying to kill you are worthy of your, you know, your mercy or your compassion is a Western liberal democracy feeling that you know, developed only in the last couple of hundred years.
Well,
otherwise it was extermination.
Yeah, it was they got it. And, we want it. Let's take it. Pretty much, right?
I'm sorry.
If they got it. We want it. Let's take it.
Well, and not just we want it. Let's take it. We're going to deal with this in a way that makes sure that once we've taken it, you're not going to be able to get it back, and you're not going to be able to get it back for generations. I mean, the idea, for example, that the Russians are kidnapping tens of thousands of Ukrainian children and taking them from their families to be raised in Russian households. I mean, that's genocide.
Yeah.
The elimination, and the Soviets did this and the Germans did this in Poland, the elimination of an entire intelligentsia, taking every historian, every political scientist, every whatever out of Polish universities, so that there would be no one to teach Polish history or Polish culture. That's genocide. Watching what's happening in the Sudan. I mean, if you watch what's happening, you see the video that those maniacs were streaming on Facebook last week, where they are going through and they're just executing everybody. They're killing families. They're killing, children, women, men, everything.
What is it? I'm trying to understand, and you probably know more about it than me. But what is it about? This is not a black or white thing. What is it about Africa? I guess maybe when you go back to Egypt or someplace, but why has there been zero democratic, no sort of what we would consider to be regular system? Is it all because it's a hunter-gatherer system? Is it because it's a hunting system? You don't need, you're always fighting over hunting grounds. You're not trying to get together and have you know, agrarian stuff and farm animals and those kinds of things where you need property raised. Is it all because of that? What causes what group?
I think it's culture, and it's the intense tribal culture and family clan culture that exists there and has existed and has not been interrupted. I mean, the best, this will sound crazy, but the best thing that happened to Africa was being colonized, because when the Brits and the French came in there, they shut all this down and you know, said we're going to operate on a rule of law rather than a rule of clan loyalty, and we're going to establish, you know, institutions that are going to function the way we want them to function, so that you can develop and you can set up an economy that works for everybody, because that'll benefit everybody. And they were able to do that. You saw the rise of culture there that was headed in the right direction for a while. The last big outpost was South Africa. Now, it came at a terrible cost there with apartheid, but they imposed effectively a Western liberal, you know, outlook on a clan tribal society. And where they were able to do it successfully, it worked. And when they took it away, when the colonial influence disappeared, it fell apart again. And that's...
It's pretty bad down there, what I hear. I don't know that it is.
And it didn't just happen there. It happened in the Balkans, too.
Yeah.
You saw the same thing. You saw the same thing boiling up out of there when Yugoslavia collapsed.
You were just there. What's the government there like there now?
But it looks like Brussels. You know, I was in downtown Belgrade and walking around, and I mean it's like any other Western.
But I mean, what's the government now since the dictator's gone and they had the big wars or fights? What did they settle into? I don't even know.
So Serbia is a very politically right-wing kind of place,
but it's on its own now. It's Serbia.
It's on its own. Okay. Yep, and it runs pretty well, but it's very homogeneous. It's fairly xenophobic. So is Hungary. they're pulling things together again around their national, and this is important because we've lost track of this. They have a national identity and they have a national culture, and they are, because they were under Soviet domination for so long, they are working to reestablish that first. And that is my take on this. And it centers, a lot of it centers around their Orthodox religion. So each country has an Orthodox church. There's a Serbian Orthodox church, there's a Hungarian Orthodox church, there's a Bulgarian and Czech and Slovak. And so these national churches provide a sort of a rallying point for the culture. And you know, maybe that's just one more variation of the kind of clannish tribal influence that we were talking about, but it's a national tribal influence, which means you've got everybody kind of pulling in the same direction, and you're expected to assimilate there, which is why those countries were absolutely adamant that they were not taking in people from the Middle East, because their perspective was, these are not people who are going to assimilate. And we only want people that are going to assimilate as we build, you know, we build ourselves back up again.
Well, I thought that about the Irish too.
So this
maybe
is,
they were right about the Irish. I don't know.
Well, this is my this is my take again. But you Vukovar and the horrors of the collapse of the Soviet sphere there, the collapse of the Iron Curtain, are not that long ago. And there is a lot of animosity, animus, angst about what happened during that conflict. And when you talk to people in the streets, and we went through Vukovar. When you talk to the people there, Vukovar was bombed to rubble. By, you know, you talk to the people there, they said, we didn't understand what was going on. We're under attack from people that the day before we were friends with, we were trading with, we would go across.
Were they bombed by the Russians?
Pardon me?
Were they bombed by the Russians or who?
No, they were bombed by the Serbs.
Okay.
they you know,
where did the Serbs get the airplanes and stuff?
Well, Yugoslavia was a Warsaw Pact country. You know, Serbia.
So they stole the Russian planes, or they had their own.
Well, they had their own. When the Soviet Union collapsed, those airplanes all stayed there. You know, that military equipment stayed there, and so they said, we're suddenly, you know, being attacked by people that we were buying groceries from the day before. You know, we didn't understand. So there's still a lot of that upset and memory there that as a result of that. Terrible, which was effectively a racial conflict or a religious conflict, but you know, the rallying cry of the far right wing Serbian government, you know, this is Milosevic and those people, the rallying cry was some conflict or battle that took place in the 1300s.
That's a while ago.
Yeah, and you try to explain to them, you know, you got to let go of this, and no, we're not going to let go of this. This is again, this is what happens when you get this subnational tribal mentality that takes hold, and it's pernicious and it lasts for a long time. And so in Africa, places like Africa, where those clans and tribes are still very powerful, this is the kind of devolution that's going on there. South Africa's a classic example. South Africa's fallen apart.
The one of the guys, one of my buddies in the Fed, went down there to do a conference, and said it was. He walked from the conference place to the hotel two blocks away. The guy said, "What'd you do that for? You're out of your mind." Evidently, a couple of cities are pretty bad.
It's not just the cities. I mean, they can't. All of the infrastructure that the white apartheid government put in place. Is falling apart. They can't, because it's being looted. Again, the tribal clannish outlook is coming to predominate, which means there's no nation. You know, the only thing you're doing is you know, your goal is to loot loot the infrastructure and turn the resources of national government to the benefit of your family or your clan and or your tribe. And that's, I mean, that's what's going on there.
Well, you know,
and it's a mess.
The overriding connection between the stuff that you and Mike's been nice enough to tweet in a couple of times here talking about, the Balkans still have this economic tension, even though it's better than it was, like you're saying, because he was over there for a while. And that's why I'm always very concerned when you start getting this economic, you know, tension of any kind. I mean, because you end up blaming people. And here in this country, we have people that, you know, I'm not going to justify letting the wrong people across the border. I don't want to get in an argument. I would never justify that. But the idea that the argument that makes sense to people or somehow is able to is those people are costing us our economy, and somehow or another we're worse off because of that. It was the exact same argument that's used everywhere. That okay, these people are
well. It gets used everywhere.
Yeah, it gets used everywhere.
Serbia. It's used in Africa.
It's page. It's chapter one of whatever playbook you happen to be using, and it's. And right now this economy is teetering a little bit, and there just was a big article here in CNBC today talking about the K-shaped recovery and how the Fed came out with all these numbers on credit card debt. And how some percentage of the population that has had housing prices go up and stock prices go up, they are actually doing better credit-wise than 5 years ago. But yet the rest of the economy, the stuff's growing, you know, 2.2% a month, and or 2.2% last year. And you look at what, you know, our government does. And when I say our government, I'm not just talking about this administration, although I have no love for this one or Biden's, or I don't know when the last one I had love for, but just the stuff you see, Lou, the Social Security, but anyone who has an ounce of brains who believes the CPI is 2.6%, for God's sake, I got a bridge for you. I mean, really? I mean, you know, this is what I've done my whole life, is inflation stuff, and it's not even close. Well, these idiots come out with a 2.6% raise in Social Security next year. Guess what the raise is in Medicare Part B, which comes out of your Social Security?
I don't know.
11%.
Okay.
Don't you think even the dumbest among us would say, wait a minute, if it's 2.6% for you, how is it 11% for me? I don't care if you're drunk in a bar and you look at that and you go, wait a minute, that's not even close. I mean, I don't know what you do about it. I mean, you're not going to get a sandwich sign and walk up down the street, but they're putting it right in your face, for God's sake.
Yeah, but they're not. Again, we've talked about that, just the total untrustworthiness of what comes out of our, you know, Bureau of Labor Statistics and some of the other folks in terms of how they're gaming the numbers.
It didn't used to be like that, though, Lou. It didn't used to be like that.
I'm going to get into my cynical self and say I actually think it probably was like that, but we just weren't as transparent. We didn't have access to the information sources that showed how this stuff was being gamed.
I'm going way back. I'm talking about when I did this stuff for Pullman. It was the late 70s, you know, early 80s. And when the inflation was 12% a year back then, and you know, your money supply was going up 12%, your inflation was, I don't know that anybody who said it was either 0 or 24. I mean, I'm not saying it wasn't 11 or 13, Lou. I mean, I'm not going to be crazy like that. But when I called the MBTA, the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority, and said, hey, the number last month was 1%, our $60 million contract is now, you know, $60,060,000. Not one person ever said, wait a minute, there was no inflation last month. What the hell are these guys talking about? How do you believe that crap? Nobody ever said that. It was pretty close.
I remember looking at those numbers and thinking, you know, my bank account is not keeping up. But I think that, and maybe there were pockets where you were getting accurate information, but we've what I've seen, and I think these numbers get rigged or altered in this service. You know, it really seems now that we have, and this is in the last 50 years, these numbers, the entire bureaucratic structure that is now the federal executive has been slaved to particular narratives and the interests of particular people, if not particular parties. And I think that's maybe what I'm referring to when I say these numbers are not reliable.
Well, I think if I were to go back, and I look at this more than I should, Lou, I would admit that to everybody. If I would take the group of people who were on Stocks and Jacks, which is about as bright a group of people I've ever come across. Some have their issues, but bright. Anyway, I would say I'll make two changes. I mean, Mike Murphy, who's going to come on tomorrow, and he's also texted in this morning with some nice questions. His mom was a gatherer of CPI information. Mom was a great lady. She had Mike, and when she ever tried to have another one like him, but ended up with like 9 daughters in a row or something. Anyway, but a great family. I don't think there was ever a second where Mrs. Murphy went out and I think Mike told me once it was rice or noodles or something. She was doing stuff in the Cleveland area. I don't think for a second she walked out and said, "Boy, looks like the price of rice is 29 cents a pack. I'll make it 25."
No.
No way she did that. Now, you look at this entire CPI. Have you ever gone through the detail on this crap? The detail is down to a gnat's ass, basically.
It wouldn't surprise me if people are doing that now, though, Tom.
Okay, but here's just check this for a second. You and I could make two changes in there that are so egregious. I think all the rest of it is pretty accurate, actually. The idea that healthcare is 6.5% of your basket. For somebody on Social Security, it's probably 40% of their basket. If you were to raise that to 20%, which it is the piece of the economy, and go back 20 years and adjust, I think it's pretty... Now you've gotten halfway there. The other one, take this absurd owner's equivalent rent out of housing. You fix those two lines, and you're pretty damn accurate. But they're not going to get fixed, because the last thing you want is somehow or another... And Carl rants and raves all the time about putting people in jail and whatever, and that's probably not going to happen. But this medical establishment, nothing has stolen as much money. They make the military-industrial establishment look like kids when it comes to stealing money from this country. I mean, now, President Trump is trying to work with these companies to lower the fatso drugs from like 1,000 a month down to 100. Well, you know, if he's successful, my hat's off to him. They forgot about the other ones, the Eliquis and all your stuff the old people are buying. But anyway, but what does that say to you, Lou, if somebody says, okay, we won't charge 1,000, we'll charge 100, and we can still make money? What does that tell you about patent laws? What does that tell you about fraud? What does it tell you about lack of competition? There's hundreds of drugs out there. I mean, what does that tell you as an attorney? What the hell?
Yeah, what it tells me as an attorney is that the regulatory scheme that gets put in place, and again, this is the weakness of our democratic system, is that people vote their self-interest, and the self-interest of politicians is to get reelected, and the health. At the same time, they are fighting with respect to the health industry. They are fighting an aggressive regulatory structure that says everything, you know, at its extreme level, says everything should be free. We're using our insurance mechanisms, which, remember, are basically risk markets. You know, that's what they're supposed to be. We're using our insurance system to try to make everything free. And so we're not trying to
make it free. We're trying to make it available to people.
Well, it's the same thing, another side of the same coin. And so we're not going to allow the insurance companies to do a risk assessment. We're going to force them into certain expenses and costs, And then when we do that, they're going to come back to us and say, we need, you know, this to happen. Otherwise, we go out of business and then nobody gets anything. So we now have this labyrinth, and that's the word I use, labyrinth of regulatory structures and costs and balance payments that are designed to try to hold this whole Rube Goldberg operation together. But at the same time, we want to try to make it as low cost as possible. The administrative costs for our health industry are something like 50 or 60% of the total cost.
I'm going to say it's higher than that.
Of the process.
I mean, I'm an old cost accountant. I'm pretty good at this.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy.
We're out of time
to start a discussion like this.
Well, real quick, and I'll let you go. And someplace somewhere, and it started with kind of insurance a little bit, but with the Obamacare and the Republicans not helping, and maybe they could have made it better. The bottom line is, if you have a drug that costs $200 a year and you're charging $7,000, I don't care where you. When we were kids, Lou, we used to say, you squeeze the silly putty here, it pops out somewhere else. No matter what you do, no matter how you move it around, you've got a problem, right? The problem is somebody's charging 100 times more than they should be. Like the fatso drugs. I shouldn't be saying that. The weight loss drugs. If somebody's charging $1,000 and it's costing them 100, you got a problem. I don't care how you figure out government, other people, you name it, charities, whatever it is, to pay the grand, it's too much. And you can never get around that. That's just my economic assessment. It's just which hat you put it under, right?
Fair enough.
Anyway, bud, when are you skiing?
Not anytime soon. We've no snow. I mean, the skiers are making their snow, but we've got no snow down here.
Are your guys all national parks like Steamboat, where you only have a certain number of days, or is anybody? I thought the only one that was privately owned was Deer Valley.
They're all on, you know, federal land, and they have pretty significant control over when you can go and how many.
But
it's
only a certain number of days, and you can apply if you get snow early, you get a couple of days early or something.
It's driven how early they open and how late they stay open is driven by a combination of things, including how late the snow is and when the Rocky Mountain Bighorn sheep start breeding.
Well, you got to have those guys breeding.
That's right.
On that note, on the breeding habits of bighorn sheep,
that's right.
talk at you next week. Jimmy, you want to go right to Andrew, and then we'll go to break 7:30?
Okay.
We'll do that. Good. Andrew, you with us?
I sure am.
Hey, have you had a chance to pile in this week on any of this veteran stuff? Sure want to get your guys' take on what's going on politically with that. And I don't know if you've... you listen once in a while. Have you been piling in on some of this stuff or no?
Oh, yeah. I know you've been dealing a lot with it earlier. Here's one contribution is, our amigo Wayne isn't with us because he couldn't get an appointment at the VA for months for an eye checkup, and he had to find a private doctor and grab it. That's why he's not with us. He says he just calls and calls. Nobody answers the phone. And, 14 years in the military, and you got to go to the private sector, find a doctor. So that's his appointment. But it's just all of these anecdotes add up to people thinking, well, what the heck is going on? And so thanks for addressing it earlier in a kind of comprehensive way.
Isn't it amazing how the unevenness of it is? You're not 25 anymore, so you've been around with the different wars. Were you surprised with Dr. Mark talking yesterday about all the different wars and the receptions and the families you come back to and where the community's together and where there's community organizations all kind of plays into the health on all this stuff? I guess I'm not surprised. I had it summed up for me that well. I mean, what'd you think?
Well, there's an amazing amount of caring people in this country who just go out and do good things, and it's always impressive to hear about it. Last week, I was with some advocates for Ukraine, a very powerful meetings. There's a film about children being blown up, kidnapped, and persevering in Ukraine. And I found myself in a U.S. senator's office with some advocates for Ukraine, and they kind of went around the table, and this one woman who was from Louisiana, she was a mother about 38, and she had had EMT training, and she said she doesn't have Ukraine background, but she's going to the front lines of Ukraine to help as a medic in a few weeks. And
wow.
Kind of lingered around the table, including with the senator's staffer, but all the rest of us, and we thought, boy, people talk about their sacrifices or their complaints, and you listen to that and try to put it into perspective.
Well, what are the I don't know of any, well, I don't know that many people in med school, but are a lot of the people, the Doctors Without Borders, they come from here?
Yeah, and you start thinking with just a little bit of imagination, what does it actually mean to be out helping people in war-torn areas? And there's no guarantees. I think of a young man that worked with me when I led a trade association, and he had been a missionary as a younger man, he went into photography, and I'm still in touch with him, seeing his photos from frontline areas of guerrilla activities in Africa or Central America, and I'm thinking, boy, this kid's got guts.
Well, you know, the movie I've covered, the young people probably don't even, you know, think it's too slow and all this. When you talk about the movie Casablanca, and they talk about that Rick, Cafe Rick, Humphrey Bogart, was a volunteer in the Spanish Civil War. Wasn't that like the original, where people, you know, if you weren't on the communist side or the other side, the loyalist side, people from all over the world went to fight there for you know, political reasons?
Well, they did. It was particularly glamorous in a sense, because one of them was Ernest Hemingway. There, and he gave it a voice through his...
For Whom the Bell Tolls, right?
Yep, exactly, his fame. But, you know, through history, there's been many many such situations. And if you take a step back to think about it, they're often quite complicated, because... We can look on the people fighting against Franco there. It's glamorous, it's et cetera. But on the one hand, he was on the communist side, and so it's the communist.
Andrew, give a little bit of the history of this guy. There was Franco was a army commander in North Africa, and he essentially invaded his own country, right?
Yeah.
And but the people he's fighting against, there was a king. Did the king die or something, or was the king on the other side?
I think that the king, the royalty, royal family has continued to the present. So in a way, it was let's say a dictatorship under a monarchy that wasn't particularly powerful.
But who were the loyalists, the anti-communists? They were just they were the old government, right? Versus Franco and the communists, correct?
Yes, but a big part of the muscle came from communists, and then, you know, kind of idealistic folks like Hemingway, let's say.
But Franco ended up getting a lot of help from Germany, which wasn't allegedly communist,
Exactly. So that's the dynamic. And Franco lasted until the mid-70s. So he ultimately prevailed. But I guess what I'm trying to do is say that in all of these conflicts, there's not necessarily a clear path, and it's certainly no fun out there, as even Hemingway's writings would illustrate.
What was it? Don't ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee, right?
Well, that's from John Donne.
Yeah.
It stays with us.
Well, that's why when we're bleeping up so much here, and I get so outraged at it, I don't really care who the president is, but to me, the last four or five have been kind of stumble bums in their own way. You see this stuff going around the rest of the world, Andrew, and it just makes me more and more, I guess people think more and more of a critic, right? I'm not being a critic. I think the U.S., if the U.S. goes down, I don't know what the world looks like in 40 years. We with all our warts, we are the shining light, for God's sake, and we better start acting like it. And we're not. I guess that's a summary of my political views. How's that?
Well, it's not just you. I think we're seeing in these election results, in the No Kings demonstration and elsewhere, that there's a lot of people who feel the same way. What real world impact it has, we're going to see a lot of it to shift the ground slightly back to economics and government policies. We're going to see the impact on what the Supreme Court does on this tariffs case that was argued yesterday.
I cannot, even though I think this what he's doing, first of all, I'm very anti-tariff. I'm a free trade guy. I would not mind, in some cases, like Carl talks about, if, you know, the simple example is if a company can't put pollution in the Rio Grande from our side, if the guy goes across the river to Mexico and then pours it in from the other side, it ends up in the same river. I wouldn't mind some sort of a tariff or embargo or something to stop that guy from doing that. I also wouldn't mind something where if we're not going to use 14-year-old girls in plants in China, they're going to. I wouldn't mind something that would even that up somewhat. But in general, I think tariffs are a horrible idea. And by the way, they're a tax on people who are too dumb to realize that it's a tax on them, which is pretty scary on top of it when we're supposed to have an educated society. But by and large, I can't believe that even if they say he used his emergency powers way more than he should have, which I think you and I agree on. When the one goofball was on Meet the Press said, it's an emergency if the president says it's an emergency. I hope they play that tape in front of the Supreme Court. I don't think you and I think that that's what an emergency is defined as. I can't imagine if they say they're illegal that they're actually going to pay the money back. Who the hell do you pay it back to? I mean, you and I just paid 40 cents more for God knows what last week. They're going to send us a check for 40 cents. Who's going to get the money?
Well, you got to the second phase. The first phase is whether they approve what he's doing. It did come out in the argument yesterday what kind of remedy might there be. But I think that the Supreme Court, if they find against it, against the administration, against the tariff power, they have ways of deciding what the remedy might be. And if it's an impossible remedy, I would imagine that there could be creative enough legally to just say, we'll just stop it going forward and not try to address.
Well, if you had a
harms in the past.
You probably don't. And I haven't had to do this in a while, but I had an older pickup truck. Somebody dented my taillight. So I went online and it was, General Motors part was $100 and somebody somewhere, I got the same damn thing for like $40 someplace. Well, now if there's a 50% tariff, that's going to be $60. If they're, well, who knows, it's a tariff on the price coming this way, not on the 40, so be careful about that. So say instead of 40, it cost me 45, because maybe when it came over, it was only $10 when it came in, and somebody's making 30 on me, which is probably true. It's not on the retail price, it's on the price when it comes over the border, correct? And so all of a sudden now, the Supreme Court says the thing's no good, which I think we both agree on. He's way overstepped his bounds. And I'm not going to get that $5. So who's going to get the $60 billion? Last thing I want is it for that going to the guys that don't deserve it.
Well, I think they'll have to be creative. And one way to be creative is, in terms of a remedy, is just to say, we can't unwind what was done, but just stop it going forward. Now, there may be some provision, some possibility of setting up some kind of class structure, special master, or something like that for major claims, but that's putting the cart before the horse. The main thing is to try to read the tea leaves of what some of the what we call conservative justices said yesterday, and they went right to the core issue: is this a tax or not?
Well, and yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
Well, and if it's a tax, that power is supposed to be with Congress. And yet the Solicitor General, John Sauer, who's from Missouri, he didn't exactly do the show-me part there, but he said, well, it's more regulation, not a tax. And we'll see how that flies.
Well, it's if everybody, again, we talked last week and you said it was because of money, but if you would think that you would think, don't you think, Lawrence, that in this country we're supposed to be somewhat educated, although somehow or another we're not anywhere near there, that with the controversy over the Reagan interview or the Reagan speech from Camp David, you would have hoped that in an educated country, when there's a big bitch back and forth about it, taken out of context or not, the damn speech can't be, is it 5 minutes long, 4 minutes long? Don't you think people could take 4 minutes out of their busy day with this controversy, go on YouTube and just listen to the whole thing? That way you can judge for yourself instead of, I'm on the right, I got to believe this way, I'm on the left, I got to believe this way. The thing's 4 minutes long, or five, maybe it's six, I don't know, you know better than me. Listen to it. Make your own goddamn opinion, for God's sake. And what Reagan said, and he categorized it, you know, I'm not a massive fan of Reagan, but there was no doubt that in an emergency situation, Congress is given the right of a president to retaliate on some tariff or trade issue, and tariffs are one of his arrows. I don't think there's a doubt about that. And Reagan explained that. He said, the Japanese, what did they do, Andrew? What was it? They did something totally untoward, and it was a new policy of theirs. And Reagan says, in response to that, I'm going to put a tariff on Japan and these products. I hate doing it because I think tariffs basically suck. They killed us during the Depression, or they didn't help. And I'm looking forward to talking to the people of Japan, and as soon as they pull back on this policy, I'm pulling back on the tariff. So he not only defined what he considered to be an emergency. An emergency only lasted until you fixed it, and then you went back the other way. That's a totally different impression than Trump attorneys trying to blow by the Supreme Court. They should just play the tape for the Supreme Court, for God's sake.
Well, exactly. And your example just now, but also earlier in our discussion about targeted tariffs, you mentioned a hypothetical situation with Mexico. These would be targeted tariffs, not against the whole country because of a irritation or a specific problem that arose suddenly in the mind of the president. So, for example, part of the argument yesterday was some of the justices were talking about, well, 50% tariff on Brazil out of the blue, how is that national security? I'm boiling it down or paraphrasing greatly, but the other example is Canada with playing Ontario played the Reagan speech, and suddenly their tariffs go up. So these are big problems for the Supreme Court majority that basically wants to, in general, empower President Trump, but they're confronted here with plain language and larger issues.
Well, everybody has to have, and this is a problem with I find with some of my conservative friends, and I'm sure if I dug into it with my liberal friends, got all you got to do. If ever you want to see a contrast, Andrew, I mean, and you're, I guess, fortunately, if that's for lack of a better term, in Washington, but here in Chicago, you listen to Trump open his mouth and you go, oh my God, where do we find this guy? And then 2 seconds later in the same news show, you'll hear the mayor open his mouth and you go, that's where we got him from. I mean, it's scary. It's almost like, what is going to, everybody's going to snap the podcast off. It's almost like they're the same person on different ends of the world. They're the people who work for them, an ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of talent. You only surround people with yes men, and it's all about you. They're the same person, just on opposite ends. It's scary to me to think that that's what we have. And Pritzker's somewhere in the middle. You know, I don't know what I think about him, but this is. There's no independent thought. There's no inclusion of everybody. There's no idea that if I do this, this might happen, or if this. I mean, there's no rigorous assessment of anything on either person, I don't think, and I find it very hard to believe because I love the city and I love the country. I don't know what to do about it. So that's where I am.
Well, I think you're doing what you can about it by hosting the show and speaking your mind. I mean, it's actually in the when in the tradition of civic enterprise or civic service, because you're doing what's within your power. And that's exactly what's needed. And I think of you getting up every day early. I know you like to hang out, and I think, day after day you're up and at 'em here doing this show. So pat yourself on the back.
Well, you know, Andrew, it is like with you guys that are on the show, it's like going back to grad school, how much you learn. It's mentally very invigorating. This week has been the most fun I've had in a while, just bringing... I've learned so much about this veteran stuff. And you know what I want to talk about the last half hour, not the whole half hour, but you mentioned we kind of touched on earlier what people do charity-wise. And obviously we have Diane Kelly is the one who started all this off by doing the stuff for Fisher House. And she actually got a few contributions from the show. And that's a volunteer group, a guy from New York, I think, named Fisher. He's probably dead now, but he started this plan. And it's essentially the Ronald McDonald plan for veterans' homes. So they raise the money. People come up with it. Now, and Kenny Polcari said, okay, I'm with this group in New York that raised $4 million for veterans' mental care, and this is what we do. This is our program. We try and put people in this 9-month program, which, you know, Dr. Mark said, well, for way of budgeting, that makes a lot of sense, but everybody's so different. You might be able to help some people in a month or two, and some people, you know, who knows how far you're going to go with that. So, I mean, yeah, you can't put every square peg is not going to go every round hole, but so it's starting to grow, and then we get the whole, you know, the whole background of it from Mark, and it started the number one place where veterans care mentally is the place in New Hampshire where he is, because the guy who brought all this to the fore and ended up being within the veterans group in Washington was a doctor and psychologist in the veterans home right near Dr. Mark. So it's kind of been growing as the week goes on, and we're trying to get bits and pieces from everybody. And Lou had his perceptions this morning, and we're going to get some from Mike Murphy tomorrow because he was over in Europe, and evidently we have homes over there as well, and he has his own perspective. So we're trying to get it from all different areas. But after break, what I'd like to kind of zero in on, what is the responsibility of charities versus government in terms of if government stayed totally out of it, I guess that would be, you know, something. I don't know. It would be a plan. We don't care about people sick. We don't care about people hungry. That was kind of the way the U.S. was for a century and a half, right? If you're starving, you know, so what? Let Catholic Charities take care of it or whoever else is doing it. Now we have a lot of places where now that's part of these, quote, programs and how well they're administrated or not administrated. And then you have charities kind of picking up around the edges or even more so to where you wonder if you're paying taxes to people who are supposed to be doing this and they're not, and charities are still picking up the pace and without getting any reward whatsoever from anybody, which this interplay here, the thing that got me, I won't say crazed, but a little weirder than it is, Andrew, there used to be, they took it off, on the debtclock.org, they used to say, back when they were called food stamps, now they're SNAP recipients, the amount of people on food stamps, and it would be like, you know, 3 million, pick a number, 3 million people, I may have to take it up during break, 3 million people, say. Then they would have another column that said, people that qualify for food stamps and don't get them. And it'd be like another 2 million people that are like, you know, essentially too proud, don't know where to go get them, do something. That how many people are, and then you go to like the Chicago Food Depository, and I think we're going to try and get somebody on from there. I think, and I could be way long, well, I think that 150,000, 200,000 people a day they feed? Oh, wait a minute. I'm paying all these taxes. The government's whining about the SNAP program. It turns out they're not even covering 250,000 people in the Chicago area, for God's sake. And you look at how many of these different food... It's like, okay, if charity's going to do it, then the government doesn't do it. Who gets that money? I mean, to me, there's this weirdo interplay going on here. And if you get a grip of what I'm talking about, after break, maybe you can opine on that. But the minute some charity does it, the government pulls back? Or how does this even work? But we're at 7:29. Why don't we go to break, come back, and then you can sort of chew on that during break. S&P futures up 16, NASDAQ futures up 66. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
We're back.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Jim Lawler on the board. S&P futures up 16, NASDAQ futures up 68. So we didn't do it earlier. Let's run through the list of what's going on in the world today. We have Andrew with us, and we're going to talk about some of these. I always like looking at the things that don't match up. Anyway, Dow futures up 37. Individual stocks, we had DoorDash is down like 40 some bucks. We had a position in there. I was bearish, but I wasn't 46 buckos bearish. We have Meta's up $5 today. We have Nvidia is up $2. Yesterday the stock was up $5 and finished down up $4. It had a $9 move in the afternoon. It doesn't seem like a hell of a lot, but that's $225 billion in market cap in like an hour and a half. I don't know what came out with that, but I also want Andrew to comment on what the story is with this guy who runs NVIDIA. He's doing the two-step between China and Trump, and I'm not so sure he isn't making pigeons out of both of them. I'm not sure, but maybe Andrew can opine on that. Over in Europe, DAX down 38.2%, FTSE down 5, call that flat, CAC around on 47.6, so slightly down in Europe. Nikkei was down huge yesterday, but today it's up 671. I think it was down like 2,000 yesterday. It's 1.3%. Hang Seng up 550. That's a big move. 2.1%. Shanghai up 38. So they bounced back pretty good, the Hang Seng and the Shanghai, but the Nikkei didn't make all of their stuff back. Oil up 45 cents, but guess what? Right at 60 bucks again, 60.05. It's stuck on that number like it was stuck on 63 for a while. Brent up 41, 63.93. We've got gold trying to bounce back here. It's up 30 bucks back over 4,000, 4,023. Silver up 40 cents, 48.43. Foreign exchange, dollar is actually has been getting very, very strong. And again, we're going to quiz Andrew on what a 2% move in the dollar. Euro was over 117, then it got under 115. Now it's 115.3. British pound up back to like 131. It was 135, down almost under 130. And we had crypto, which was causing the problem the other day. Ethereum, Kevin corrected me. I was calling it Ether. It's Ethereum. Bitcoin's down 684, 103, 267. And Ethereum, which had the 12% move down the other day with some kind of a hack, is down 72 bucks, 33.86. Jimmy, what do you got for us? Quick traffic, weather, sports. Not a whole lot of sports last night.
Just the NBA, and the Bulls were not part of it. But today we do have on the inbound Kennedy from is 22 minutes from Montrose. Going down to the Edens, inbound from Lake Cook is 36 currently. On the Eisenhower, the inbound from Wolf is 40 minutes. The inbound from the Dan Ryan to the Jane Byrne Interchange is 30 minutes even. Back to you, Chief.
So, Andrew, what do you... I just was doing some numbers here. The debt clock, boy, was I off. That's why once in a while you got to check this stuff. Food stamp recipients in this country, take a guess.
How many?
Yeah.
You tell me.
Almost 42 million. And I will bet there's another 15 to 20 that they really looked at their stuff, probably would qualify and either are too proud or don't know it. And then now I look at the food depository in Illinois, and the latest AI says in 2016, which is a while ago, 160,000 meals per day. So now I think they probably get help from the SNAP program, but I don't know. Jimmy, you might know more than that because you volunteered over there a little bit. But how does this? I mean, I, on the one hand, I love the fact that Kenny Pulcheri's group is coming up with $4 million, which is really something that they raised last week for veterans' mental care. And then I see Wayne not being able to get an eye doctor appointment, and I don't really want the government pulling back and giving money someplace I don't know where it to go and having other people, me and you and Jimmy and everybody else on the show, having to pony up for the government, you know, because what Trump doesn't want to, or not just him, but we don't want to spend money on the veteran stuff. There's this interplay here that I find very unnerving. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. And not to foreclose what I'm sure will be a enlightening back and forth, but to jump ahead to a logical conclusion, you need decent, thoughtful, civic-minded people administering things in both government and the private sector, because that's ultimately got to be the solution. But let's have the back and forth.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was talking to Kenny, and we'll come out more next Tuesday. We're probably going to have on Veterans Day, which I think is Tuesday, is the 11th, right? We're going to have trying to get Diane and Kenny on, and Kenny was very, very careful to say that they're pretty independent from the veterans' homes. I mean, they're not going to give the Heinz Group and Maywood a bunch of cash to go out and hire people. I mean, we'll learn more about how he's going to do it. We didn't have a chance, but I think they want to keep it separate. I don't think they're happy with what's going on in the Veterans Administration. But if you start treating people in the hospital because you don't think they're being treated there, or maybe they're just, we'll ask them, that they're trying to treat people that are not in the hospital. Well, that's only half the people then, right? Or, I mean, I mean, the whole interplay here, the detail is pretty interesting, isn't it, Andrew?
Yeah. Well, here's one way to think of it. Perhaps ideally, the government programs are a baseline that you don't want people dying of hunger on the streets, et cetera, or, you know, disrupting schools because they're desperately hungry. You know, the old thing, taking somebody's lunch money? Well, do we really need that in some difficult school districts instead of just making sure the kids are not hungry when they go to school? But the charitable aspect is to target a population that's in particular need or particularly worthy. But to my mind, the problem with over-reliance on charities is that somebody's idea of particularly worthy groups, leaving behind others to is not a great idea too, either. In other words, do only certain populations have charities that are going to help them? So that's why I think there needs to be a balance.
And you know, I don't know how you that's a real struggle. That would be I would think that maybe one line of demarcation would be the charity would focus on people that are not in the hospital, and maybe the veterans people have their out clinics like Wayne goes to or would like to have gone to, because they have out clinics. I mean, my stepfather was when he got his drugs through the veterans, but even though he had a private physician, you had to go to a veterans guy to say, yeah, those are the drugs you need, and then they would come cheaper in the mail. But there was a veterans doctor's office in Evergreen Park or in Oak Lawn or someplace that you would have to go, and they had a couple guys there that were they were fine, they were good. I think they both closed. I don't think they're there anymore. I don't know if he would have had to go all the way out to Heinz now or whatever. And there's also an interplay between the state veterans' retirement homes and the veterans' home. They don't get any money from the Fed. And the one he was in, and who was it was Diane was just saying that one of the people from Hines got into the one in Quincy, which is over on the river, and the place is half full. They had a waiting list for 6 months, and the wait place is half full because the state doesn't have enough money to staff the place. Well, wouldn't you think that, you know, you'd pony up a little more dough and take a lot of these people, you know, I'll use the term off the street or somewhere else? I mean, it seems like we're not spending money in the intelligent ways. We're doing them in the political ways, which I guess we've always done that, right?
Well, to some extent, but what you're talking about is a higher level of problem solving. It's not that high level, but in Wayne's case, and he can talk about it if it's important next week, but they literally don't have people answering the phones, he says, at the VA, much less doing the kind of coordination you're talking about.
Well, which whenever you and Wayne talk, or anybody here, you always lead me into other questions. Like I said, my stepfather, we managed to get him into one in Mantino, which is closer. I wouldn't drive to Quincy every Saturday because I had to go see him. My brother went two nights a week, and I went on Saturday because my brother lives on the south side. And I'm going to say very few people there had people seeing him 3 days a week. Most people didn't have anybody seeing him. Pretty sad when you think about you drop your dad off, and the next time you see him is in a funeral home. But that's really the way it worked. But, you know, so Tammy Duckworth, before she became a senator, became head of the Illinois Veterans Group. Okay, and I have a lot of respect for Tammy Duckworth, but on an objective scale, Andrew, I don't know, since my stepfather had passed by the time, I don't know that when she came in, when she left, the TVs were newer in the place. Instead of being 50% full or 40% full, it was now 70% full. I have no idea whether she did a good job or not. How could I know? I mean, these people that get these jobs, and what's the guy? The guy was a mayor from South Bend. He became Biden's, you know, interior guy. And people, it's all politics. Well, the guy's gay, he's this or that, whatever. They don't like the guy, whatever he does. How do we have any idea whether these guys or ladies do a good job or not, whether we should promote them into the next spot? I mean, it seems like we end up with people in these positions that, for God's sake, if you ask them to write a 100-word essay on what they just said, they're incapable of doing it. I mean, you wonder where we get them. I mean, how does anybody have any idea in these offices whether somebody's doing a good job or bad?
Well, to the extent that we have an interest in it, we can do research and find out what people have said about the people who work with them and so forth, and that's a lot of what I do. And there are, you know, vast numbers of other people trying to do that research in a targeted way. But the disconnect is that after the preliminary research is done, to answer the kind of question you have, where does it go? How does it get out? And who's going to do something about it? Now, traditionally, this is what the news media should have done, or should do, but they've got their financial constraints, and they're whacking down the number of reporters, editors, and so forth, and people don't read them that much anymore. But that's also what Congress and the inspector generals for each department are supposed to do. So under Carter, they created the inspector general system, where every federal department was supposed to have an inspector general who was semi-independent to research the effectiveness. And they'd have staffs and do supposedly independent reports. Well, it's barely made any headlines, but Trump has fired dozens of them. Dozens. And so it's it's loyalists now, and to get spread blame around, the Democrats for years ceded to Republicans, ceded with a, spelled with a C, they gave up the issue of waste, fraud, and abuse to the Republicans when it was originally the Democrats who started these inspector generals to find waste, fraud, and abuse.
Is that what Truman, was Truman?
No, that's Jimmy Carter.
Well, I thought Truman did some of that during the war.
Well, he did a lot of it. That's how he became vice president because, and we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, he led at the Senate an oversight commission on profiteering on war contracts. And that's how he made his fame. And it was during the middle of the war, of course, it was Roosevelt was the president, his same party, and one of Roosevelt's sons was implicated in some ways in the profiteering.
Was his first name Hunter? Hunter Roosevelt?
I think his name was Elliot Roosevelt.
Yeah.
But people like Howard Hughes, who had all kinds of big war contracts, they'd have what was benignly referred to as party girls, who would work with the war contractors to have quote-unquote parties with well-connected people. And Roosevelt's son was kind of caught up into that. But Congress and the Senate was independent enough in those days that they laid out some big scandals, and that was part of our process. Now, we're not seeing that from the Senate these days.
When I first got to the trading floor, the term, I would party with you, meant all night.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I have not heard that term in like 30 years, though, have you? In that context.
But these are continuing problems, but we used to have a better system to bring it out and deal with it.
What is your? I'm gonna throw you a curve here, only because I know you can hit the curve. This is one.
Don't say that to my high school baseball coach. I went from batting third to batting ninth, if at all, because of that. But well, I digress.
Well, and this Wayne might have a little more, because you're worrying more about some of the court cases. So I'm getting really nervous about this government-private partnership, and this thing with NVIDIA, I don't think this guy gives a rat's behind about the U.S. I think he's playing China against us. Last week he said China's going to win the AI war, and then all of a sudden somebody invested some money somewhere from the government. Now, okay, maybe we can win, and now Trump's trying to take a piece of Westinghouse. We don't know where we're going on this, but we're well on our way. I'm very nervous about the whole mess. I don't want a German society here where government has a piece, or through the main banks has a piece of the companies that they're going to preference for the next 30 years. I don't want to go there, but how am I going to stop that? And I think this guy from NVIDIA is, I don't know the man personally, but it seems to me like he's in the middle of something here that I don't think he ought to be. Or is it just me?
No, I think you're exactly right. And he's playing a very complicated game, but it makes me think of the movie version of James Bond or something, except this is real life. People have to have high risk tolerance and to play that game. But, the stakes are absolutely astronomical for our country, investors, but the profitability or the power of these people playing the game makes them take risks that are not necessarily acceptable for the country, but are certainly in their own personal interests.
Andrew, you're a attorney for a long time and a moral guy, and and plus you come on our show, so that makes you good. When you see something like Kevin sent around, let's say I should have forwarded it to you and Wayne, I didn't. When Kevin sent around two articles, and Kevin's very conservative, but he also has a moral fiber to him. Not that most conservatives don't. It's not what I meant. I mean, you know, Kevin's capable of looking at both sides. He sent around two articles. If I can find them, I'll send them to you, Wayne. One of them had to do with the Chinese phobia, it appears, of keeping track of all their citizens, and seemingly keeping track of all their citizens over here as well. And who knows if that's, you know, if they're keeping track of other people here, but their own citizens, it seems fairly documented that they're doing just that. And if one of the students acts up over here, his family pays for it over there. It turns out that IBM has been like the major supplier of this stuff. That's like article one. The other article is President Trump has tried, and hats off to him, has tried not to give, they call them chips, but they're not really chips, they're processors, they're big, huge chips, to the best processors of China for fear they're going to use them for military stuff. And I'm with him on that. My hat's off to him, and I don't know how the hell he or his group figures out which ones are you can use and which ones you can't. I mean, that's way above my pay grade. So I'll just say I'm with him on it, is all I'm saying. Now, the other article Kevin sent said, well, okay, they're not sending them NVIDIA's best chip, but they're letting them rent space in the cloud here through, you know, whatever firms are in there. I don't want to name them because I've named the wrong ones. Where they're getting into the same place, they're just buying cloud time here of the same chip they can't have over there. I mean, I'm not, as you probably well know, Andrew, I'm a son of an Irish cop, okay, so I don't really like people breaking the law. Do I have to be worse than Trump and stomp into the IBM boardroom with about 15 guys, and I won't put masks on them, and wheel them all out in cuffs? What do I have to do to give an example that this shit isn't right? I mean, these guys, I don't think, you think IBM at this point gives a rat's ass about us? I mean, even though they're, I mean, I'm sure there's maybe an IBM listening and saying that he's horrified I said that. What do we have to do? Do we have to drag him out into the street and throw tomatoes at him? I mean, our law doesn't seem to be able to deal with this at all.
Well, if people wanted a law to deal with it, they'd push for it in effective ways. And what you're talking about is a general sense that this isn't right, this isn't the American way, but that general sense has to be translated into laws and enforcement. And what you say prompts a number of thoughts of mine, and let me try to boil it down to a core example or two that, and I'll try to bring a Chicago element to it. But one, when I was head of a high-tech trade association, the Wireless Communications Association, one of our members was Quest, which was one of the seven Baby Bell companies. And I noticed...
Yeah, which part of the country were they?
Well, they're in the kind of Rocky Mountains.
Okay.
And...
Because there was a Mountain Bell, right?
Yeah, there. But these were one of the... After the breakup of AT&T, it's one of the seven...
Somebody changed their name.
Ameritech was
Chicago. I think somebody changed their name to Quest because there was Mountain Bell, there was Southwest Bell, there was...
Yeah, they might have. Well, yeah. Southwest Bell basically acquired most of them, including Pacific Bell, and through a re-merger process. But at any rate, the head of Quest, a guy named Joe Nacchio, was... on the advisory committee for President Bush's high-tech group, National Security Board, and the people from the Bush administration, basically to boil things down, said, well, we'd like to have all your customer data. And Quest was a major contractor across the country with the federal government. So they didn't just serve businesses and consumers out around Colorado, but they had lots of federal contracts nationwide. And Nacho, who I later got to meet personally, he said, well, sure, I'd be glad to hand over. Just give me a warrant or some authorization. And they didn't do that. They took it as a sign of disloyalty. And he was basically trying to work with the administration. He was a leader in the Bush administration, but he also needed to protect himself by asking for a warrant or some official order to hand over all his private, all the private information. So they wouldn't give him that, and said they indicted him for using some of his stock options as insider trading, and he went to prison.
Really?
And I followed that case pretty closely, even though I was running a trade association. And later, when I went back to reporting and research, I looked into it even more. And I found that people who I knew from the University of Chicago, where I went to law school, were very involved on both sides of that. On the one hand, one of my contemporaries and friends was a prosecutor of him that successfully won the conviction. And one of my professors, Michael McConnell, was a judge who raised questions about this, because and my ultimate conclusion on it was that he was politically targeted to make an example of an executive who was asked to give over private data on customers without the normal warrants or paperwork. And that's part of our slide to what concerned you just now, which is, what about all our data? What about all of these things? What about China? Ultimately, even this a very wealthy, well-lawyered CEO of a major company could not resist this process. And by coincidence, I thought, I wonder if I could find his lawyer, whether they would talk to me and give the lawyer's perspective. And then I looked it up and I thought, gee, I know his lawyer, and who privately told me this is one of the biggest regrets, that they couldn't win this case before the Supreme Court. And this client had to go to prison.
Yeah, it's but I mean, some of the stuff, it's almost, just to talk about a wacky story, when you used to hang around in the South Shore neighborhood, I know, if you went to the University of Chicago, right? Well, I was two summers at South Shore High School, right? And the head janitor there was a guy named Ellie Walker. Big black guy, real nice guy. And I very, very well educated. I don't know why, but he, one day, he's kind of in a bummed out mood, and I go, Ellie, what's up? And he says, well, my son, he's trying to be slick. That was a term he used. And he goes, two things. One is, he's trying to be slick, which I guess everybody does. He goes, the other thing is, he's so bad at it, it's almost insulting. my intelligence. Wow. He goes, I was way better. I actually could put one by the old man once in a while. He goes, he's so bad at it, it almost insults me. I feel the same way, where, okay, you guys can't have NVIDIA's best chip, meaning China. That's okay. We'll have some firm called Wayne Matson Inc. He's going to put five of them in his garage. And by the way, we're just going to use the ones in his garage. I mean, it's almost at a point where don't insult me. I mean, for God's sake. I mean, these guys aren't even, they're not even being slick. It's insulting.
Well, you know, people are playing the long game. If I have a shorter story than may be relevant. Sorry for the long-winded one.
No problem.
But the shorter story is, I mentioned that we had this trade association, and so a lot of our manufacturers wanted us to put on a big event in Singapore in 1998, and we did. And they thought, gee, we've got the Chinese market right there, and we'll go and show off our stuff, our antennas, and all of our equipment, and this will be great. Well, it was very complicated to do, and but you know, as president, I organized it, and I did what the manufacturers wanted. And then one of them from an Iowa company, he comes up to me and he says, this is an outrage. There's a Chinese company that's using exactly our antennas in the booth next to us, and they're selling it for half the price. What's the matter with you? And I said, well, look, we put on this show at your request. But don't blame me. And
well, it's your fault you gave them the booth right next to the guy.
Yeah, and by the way, if we didn't have this show, you wouldn't have known that they stole your antenna.
God. Well, Wayne, we got a Andrew, we got a dash. Hope Wayne's okay, and we'll talk to the boat of you guys, as they say, on the south side next week. SP Futures right. Up 8, NASDAQ Futures up 25. We'll see if this... Yesterday we came back about... 40% of the day before, it was not a Fibonacci replacement. We'll see if we do the rest today. I'm back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.